Hi, I'm Andy Reid.
And I'm Mike Porter.
You're listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations, which is aired on the third Wednesday of each month from 2 until 3 p.m. on WGXE Acra 90.7 FM.
On each show, invited guests will be asked to discuss a number of items that they intend taking with them on their Catskill Cabin getaway. As we discuss their chosen items, it is hoped that you, the listener, will enjoy getting to know that person a little bit better.
Usually at this point, we would introduce our guest. However, given that today marks the end of our first year and the beginning of our second with Catskill Cabin Conversations, we wanted to take the opportunity to reflect back on some of the best moments from our guests throughout 2013-2014.
You are about to hear excerpts from our shows with Chris Hack, Mark Mbirowick, Pam Slater, Jess Puglisi, Linda Nichols, Reggie Wilcox, George Patterson, Joanne Conlin, Patricia Charbonneau, and Lynn Sloniker. These are some of our favorite moments, and we hope you enjoy listening to them as much as we do. Chris, thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming, mate.
So how's your weekend going so far?
So far, so good. Bow season just ended. Rifle season starts today. Deer on the move. Snow's coming. Winter season's about to be here. Good time to be up here in the mountains.
Yeah. I'm not a hunter, I have to say. I'm a city boy, but I appreciate the enthusiasm that people are looking forward to the hunting season. But
I appreciate that they thin out the deer population so I don't have to do it with my car.
Yeah, I just missed a deer last week by inches. I was telling Chris on the way here that, I just missed one last week, and he said the best way to do it is just to put the pedal to the metal and hit it, because if you don't, and you're going too slow, it could come straight into the windscreen. Am I right in saying that?
Really? You're right. The general rule of thumb is if you're going to hit a deer, don't hit the brakes, hit the gas.
Yeah, nail it. No kidding.
I don't know if I would actually use that rule, but that's what they tell me.
I'm an animal lover.
Yeah. And Mark, you mentioned cruising. Another thing you were going to bring to the Catskills was a White Lake Speedway pit pass car photograph. Tell us about that.
Well, the pit pass was, as I said, again, influenced by my father, body and fender work and painting. I got into restoring cars, and of course, when we got back into plumbing, he put all that away. And then when I became a teenager and interested in cars, it all came back out again, all the body and fender tools and the spray guns and all that sort of thing. And so he was teaching me how to do all of this work. And I started restoring cars, and I would buy a car, I'd fix it up, I'd sell it, I'd make money, take another one, and do the same. And my cousin, though, he was into racing. He was really into more of the drag racing. He lived in Floral Park, Long Island.
So can I just ask, is that driving cars?
Yes.
Dressed in drag?
Drag racing. No, no.
Oh, sorry.
Had nothing to do with what they wore.
All right. I thought these guys driving cars fast with dresses on.
No. No, let's get that clear. But there were a lot of drag tracks down where he lived. Englishtown, New Jersey was
and
one of the
we
Hamptons.
Are, RuPaul.
Yeah.
in his yeah. 67 Chevelle.
Yeah, right.
Anyway,
he influenced me. My cousin did. For a short time to get into racing, and so I found a track, a pavement oval track in White Lake near Monticello, White Lake, New York. And most of the tracks around here are dirt tracks. This was not a dirt track. So I got a 68 Pontiac. I outfitted it for the stock class, and I raced for one season, and it was a really neat experience.
Excellent.
It was fun.
Now, can I just ask, the song Molin' a Feelin', is that related? Is that something you would play when you're driving fast cars? Here's the reason I'm asking, because the person who wrote the song, Schultz, I think his name's Tom Schultz.
Tom Schultz.
He quoted this. He said this, and I quote: "This song is about the thrill one gets when driving fast cars."
No kidding.
Yeah.
No, I did not know he said that.
Yeah. So there you are. So see.
Well, there's something to relate to.
Yeah.
So did you ever crash at high speed?
I had more wrecks than I had wins. Yeah.
Wow.
And is it? But as I said, it was for fun. There was no money in it. The car, keeping the car going, and so you could come back and race another week.
Yeah.
It was expensive. If I had won every race that season, I wouldn't have been able to pay for the car. So it was for fun. It was just fun.
Yeah. I remember watching this sports program every Saturday afternoon in Scotland or Britain in the 70s. It was called World of Sport, and introduced by Dickie Davis. And they had, every now and again, they had this racing contest. It was cars just crashing into each other. Mm-hmm. And the one that won was the one that was left standing. Is that anything that you did? Was that
demolition derby?
This
was not demolition derby. No. Actually, by the end of the race, it would sometimes look like it. There were very few races I recall not being towed off the track. So there was the best night I had was I had won a qualifying heat, and I got pole position in the feature race, which I had never gotten before. So I took that, and I went one lap around, and then someone got out in front of me and completely turned around, and I hit him in a head-on collision.
Ooh.
And the hood pushed up into the windshield, and the windshield, you know, was all destroyed. And that was the end of that night.
Yeah.
So the closest I got one lap into a feature race. I had a good position, but
at least you can
see a lot of things happened on the track.
I was out in front.
You know? Yeah, but that was the, and of course I hit the wall a few times, and that was.
We've all hit the wall a few times, mate. I'll tell you. Pam, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hey there, Pam. Thank you for coming.
You're welcome.
So, how's your winter been going so far?
Cold.
I want to point out that George is the contributor of the beginning and ending music of the show, the introductory music, which George wrote. Did you write that yourself, George?
That's written in conjunction with my songwriting partner, Mr. Gordon Moyer.
Right. So we'd like to thank you,
Mr.
officially.
Moyer. And Mr. Donaldson as well.
Yes, we'd like to thank you officially for giving us the rights to use your music. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, George.
We would like to thank you guys for paying the royalties on it. So thank you very much.
About that, one of your henchmen stopped by. The check is going to be in the mail tomorrow. Jessica, you mentioned listening to music as you're driving. Have you taken any road trips recently?
Nothing substantial, you know. I mean, not for a while, I guess. Not. I mean, you know, I drove around with a friend for like, you know, 4 hours last Sunday.
Nice.
You know, but, or actually, you know, even, you know, yeah, definitely like spend some time in the car that's not as purposeful as it should be, I guess.
I think in my lifetime I've taken one Sunday drive, and I was maybe 9, and it was awful. And it was in Western New York near Lake Ontario near Barker. That's where my grandparents lived, and my grandparents were from, you know, the older Great Depression generation, where everyone went to church on Sunday, did the Sunday drive, looked at, you know, all the neighbors' lawns, saw what the neighbors were doing. But as a kid, it's just like, I want to get out and run and play, and I don't want to be stuck in this car looking at houses. Where, you know, I don't even know these people, and but I think it was a big cultural thing for a while.
Absolutely.
You know, the Sunday drive.
I love driving.
Yeah. Well, this, I was actually, you know, I think I was commenting during one of these recent drives, or sometimes surrounding that, about I'm trying to figure out what moment in my life, and maybe it's just when you actually learn to drive for yourself, where it goes from what you're describing, Mike, where like being in a car for a long period of time is a way that your parents torture you, to being the most like pleasant, wonderful like way to spend time, and just, you know, getting to see, like, you know, each glance out the window is like a different landscape painting, you know.
Yeah. Although I've discovered recently a lot of my friends are getting married and having kids, and nowadays they have SUVs, Jeeps, vans with video games, DVD players. Like, the age of are we there yet, I think, has come to a screeching halt.
Yeah, I mean, I was about to say that. I mean, kids don't even look outside the window anymore. They're watching movies and playing games.
You know, even so that there's like two DVD players in the same car, and you can have different music, and someone can be playing video games, and, you know.
You know, they're getting that big now as well. You can have a bouncy castle in the back, you know.
It's going to be great. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
And then they'll have self-driving cars, so I can be in the bouncy castle.
Play area annex in the back of the car, you know.
I just remember we had like a minivan when I was a kid, and it was a big deal who got to sit next to it there, because there was a radio tuner on like one side of it.
Cool.
And we would wrestle for, I mean, it was like whoever got that was really lucky. Uh-huh. And then it was just a matter of whether or not our parents would actually.
Can I tell you a story? When I was a kid, I went fishing with my dad and my uncles.
and my dad's close friend, and the car was a heap of junk, and there was like eight of us in the car, and we had to go on a ferry, and you know, across to where we're going to camp, and the car, every time the car stopped, it would stall, so we had to push the car onto the ferry. Right, now, this was a really busy ferry, and I remember being about 13, and I saw this girl standing looking over to the sea, and her eyes kind of met, and I was like, you know, looking at her, I was like, she's really pretty. And then I had to push the car off the ferry, and I was like, well, any chance I ever had of, you know, falling in love with that girl were completely dashed when she saw me pushing a old wreck of a car. Me and the rest of her redneck family pushing this car off a ferry. And, yeah, that was one of my memories of Sunday drives. Linda, you would like to take a small piano with you, and I emphasise the word small piano with you to the Catskill cabin getaway. Why? Tough question.
I can't imagine being any place without having music.
Right.
I just can't. And I love to write music, so I would be lost without some way to create music.
Linda, I couldn't believe that you're self-taught. You taught yourself how to play the piano.
Yeah.
that is incredible. And to paint, really?
I guess I owe it to my parents, my grandparents, who had a gift to do this. And I just, you know, and listen, we, coming from a Scottish background and an Italian background, there's a lot of music. There's a lot of dancing, a lot of just joyous music. And I wanted very much to learn how to play. And since my dad was a self-taught musician as well, he wasn't always able to tell me, you know, how to really read music for piano, because he played by ear. So I just plunked it out. And having played violin, I knew how to read music for the right hand. And then my uncle showed me, okay, this is what you do for the bass clef. And he would leave me some of his old piano books, and I'd just plunk away. But of course, my fingering had a lot to be desired. So when I did get to Wagner, the professor there was not too happy with what he saw, and how he knew. He'd be across the room and I'd be playing, and he would stop me. No. It was an old German professor, and he really took me to task there. And I had to relearn a lot of the fingering.
Were your fingerings just maybe inefficient?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. I wasn't able to do, you know, the runs and mm-hmm. the scales and all the things like that would have made it easier for me to play. But I'm back to my old fingering now.
Old habits die hard.
Yeah, I'm back. I'm more comfortable what works.
But you enjoy it, don't you?
Oh, I just love it. Yeah. I have a keyboard at home. It's a Yamaha Clavinova that has all the bells and whistles, so I can record, you know, 16 tracks, orchestrate things, burn them onto a CD, and then, you know, people can sing through the microphone, and it's just, I don't need anything else. You know, I have my dad's grand piano that's in my daughter's house right now, and we're hoping that it'll get to our house. But he left me his grand piano, so...
Beautiful.
Brilliant. That's what's nice. So I think of him every time I play that.
Yeah. 12,000 parts make up a piano. 10,000 make the sounds.
You've been doing your research.
And do you know that in a symphony orchestra, it is a percussion instrument? Mm-hmm. Not a string instrument. Mm-hmm. I thought it was
the hammers.
String instrument, because of the strings, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I am wrong. So that was one of the questions I was going to ask. It's a grand piano, baby grand?
Baby grand, yeah.
Cool. So obviously there's two types, an upright and
baby grand. Upright, yeah, the upright, and then you have a spinet, and then a console, and a baby grand. Really, it's just the size, you know, the different sizes of the grand pianos. And, right. They're wonderful. And if the action is really easy, your fingers just kind of glide right over, and it's wonderful.
Now, what do you call the keys? There's several names for the keys. The ivories, the 88s, the black and whites.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess I never really had a nickname for them. You know? I guess I call them keys.
Keys.
My granddaughters, and we play, and I say, okay, play this key. And right. So I guess keys. Yeah.
My grandmother had a piano in her house in Glasgow when I was growing up. And every time we sat down to, you know, play it, you know, when I say play it, I mean hit the keys. she would crack up and she'd get away from that, put that down, you know. And so we never got to play it, but it's one of those instruments. I've never learned to play an instrument. Mm-hmm. All I've done is sing throughout my life. But I always remember that it was an upright piano that my gran had, and I think my mum played piano in her younger years.
You have to start, because with all that musical history, you probably have a gift for playing. It's never too late.
Well, it's never too late. Yes, and I think with me, it's the concentration span. You know, I've always thought to myself, I'd love to play the guitar, but every time I try and learn, I'm like, okay, time for a coffee. It's only 10 minutes gone, you know, and I'm like, okay, I'll just sing then. So, yeah.
Do you play an instrument, Mike?
I do. I played the trombone in school and play once in a while, and but not a whole lot anymore. I always wanted to learn how to play the piano, and I have pretty decent hands for it, I think. But just never really had the opportunity. Maybe someday.
You should, yeah.
It's inspired to take it up.
A friend of mine just retired from dentistry, and that's what he wants to do, learn how to play piano.
Cool. Yeah.
He's 66 and ready to start.
You going to teach him?
No.
See, I tell you what, you give me free dental work, and I'll teach you how to play the piano. You make my dentures, and I will...
Yeah, we'll exchange ivories. Right?
Bartering. Bartering talent.
Well, you know, one of the things is I have to credit my father a bit, because when I graduated from high school, right out of high school, he got me a job as an NBC page at NBC. And it was a kind of fun thing, because my first assignment was to take care of Jinx Falkenberg and Tex McCreary. And Jinx Falkenberg was beautiful. She was a wonderful person. And when I first met her in the inner sanctum of NBC studios, you know, with the dim lights, these little lights up in the ceiling, and there in the dimness in the morning, she said, I take my coffee with two cups of, you know, two sugars and the milk, and that's the way I do it. And so my introduction was to Jinx Falkenberg. And so I got her coffee every morning. And the interesting thing about that was we had the introduction at the same time of the new 45, you know, record player.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Well, Mike doesn't, I do.
And we had to do an advertisement for the New York Times, and they took me and put me in an advertisement for NBC, and I was holding that 45 player in my arm. I've got the picture at home. I'll show it to you, but... There I was in my uniform with the chevrons and the brass buttons and all that stuff.
So was it a photo ad or a commercial ad?
It like was a photo ad for the 45 degree being announced by Rockefeller, you know, RCA.
So you've also done a little bit of modeling.
Well, it was a fun thing to do. But, you know, in getting into music, when you talk about the music I had, my natural instincts, it was a funny thing because I did a good job with Jinx Falkenberg. You know who they made me take care of next time was Milton Berle. Mm-hmm. I had to take care of his studio. He had Studio 6B, and 6B was where Milton Berle operated. And he'd come in with his big bathrobe and his maroon colors and a big Turkish towel around his neck. He used to have a cigar that was about 12 inches long or more. Big thing, and he would come and he'd take a phone, and I had to realize then you have to catch the phone because you never hung it up.
But didn't you learn the hard way?
I did. It went across my nose and busted my lip.
So how did this happen?
I got a phone call for Milton Berle, and I said, Mr. Berle, call. It's your agent. And he says, thank you. And he took the cigar out of his mouth, took the phone, and he started to walk away from me. I went back looking at my desk, and when I turned around, I got caught the phone right across the bridge of my nose and in my mouth. And they said, didn't you know? You have to catch the phone, because he never hung it up. And it was a kind of an interesting thing. But from there...
That's a hard way to learn.
I did that for quite a while. But then the next thing, they gave me an assignment with Arturo Toscanini in Studio 8H. And Studio 8H was the largest studio in the world. And the kind of interesting thing there was that Arturo Toscanini came up to me and he said, I want to tell you something. And I said, yes, sir. He said... Not even my family comes into this studio when I'm rehearsing. You understand? And I knew it was going to be under penalty of death, the way he said it. I couldn't dare let anybody in that studio, not even the president of NBC or RCA. Nobody could come in that studio when he was rehearsing. but I had the advantage of listening to him rehearse the symphony, and it was the finest studio in the world, Studio Age. And finally, after that, we were on the elevator, and my Howie Bear, my supervisor, he said, there's a big get-to-do in the Rainbow Room, yeah. And you want to be very careful about this, because I see any one of you up there, you're going to be fired. Do you understand me? We said, yes, sir. We even got that in the morning when we lined up for inspection. They checked our fingernails, make sure everything was right. Our ties were tight. Everything was great. And that night was that big thing at the RCA Rainbow Room. Well, lo and behold, I get in the elevator, and guess who's in there? Marilyn Monroe. And she took a look at me, and she said, you're cute. And I said, oh, boy. Anyway, there was three of us in there, pages, and we were there with Marilyn Monroe in the elevator. And she said, you know, I like you boys. You work so hard. You're all my guests. You're coming to the Rainbow Room as my guests tonight. So we kind of looked at one another because we just heard
they
were going to get shot. Anyway, that night, we all said, should we or shouldn't we? We said, oh, let's go do it. This is a one chance. So we went up there, and we were sitting at a table. Marilyn Monroe came over, and she said, I'm so glad you young fellas are here. You need anything to drink? You want, you know, whatever you have, it's on me. And she's sitting there, and all of a sudden, in walks Howie Bear, our supervisor. Uh-oh. I thought he was going to have a heart attack. Yep. He took one look at us, and he came over, and Marilyn Monroe turned around and said, how are you, Mr. Bear? I know you. These boys are my personal guests. And he was flabbergasted. He could do nothing. He could do nothing.
Wow.
Did you just sit there and smile at him?
Yes, we did, and it was some party. Marilyn Monroe was an expert gal, I'll tell you. We had such a good time.
Wow, that's such memories, isn't it? Now, family is obviously very important to you, yeah?
Yes, my family is extremely important to me. We right. grew up with a very tight-knit family.
Mm. And what makes those times special? What do you do that makes it special?
Well, we always had, holidays were always extremely family-oriented. We had Christmas dinners. We had, every holiday was surrounded by food. No wonder I need to be in the gym. But everything was surrounded by food, whether it was a wedding, a funeral, you know, anybody stopping over, food was involved. So that cooking, eating, being together, that was all like things that we all did as we grew up.
And I bet it was really beautiful home style cooking, you know, like Italian food marinated for hours. And
it was. We had always had a garden out in the back. Small patch. I mean, we lived in Brooklyn, but that patch of garden, it was dirt, and they were growing tomatoes, zucchini, so we grew fresh vegetables.
Yep.
We ate, you know, we ate well, and it showed sometimes.
And Joanne, along with your list of songs and items that you'd like to take to your cabin in the Catskills, you also gave us a short story to read titled No One Covered the Fig Tree.
No one, that and, is my life. And I think every Italian-American family kind of had that same upbringing. That brings tears to my eyes when I read
it. Yeah, and I think it's kind of bittersweet because there seems to be this great reflection on the way things used to be, but how it's just not like that so much anymore.
No. Mm. When we grew up, everyone lived in a 5-block radius. Then as each generation went on, I mean, obviously I moved upstate, you know, a lot of family moved to Long Island. Like my own children, they go back, and we still have that headquarters because my Aunt Nancy, out of the 5, is the only one living. So we go back to visit her, and that brings back that family. But my children, they get it, but it's not quite the same.
Yeah.
It's bittersweet.
Yeah. So the families have almost really kind of been assimilated, and certainly there are some Italian elements that we find in American culture, but it's not quite the same pure. Did you guys really, in the story it talked about, there was a person for everything that would come to your house to sharpen knives, or a vegetable guy, a chicken guy. You really had those?
We really had those. I mean, it was towards the end of mine. It was getting to be less and less. Mm. But we had, there was different. there was definitely the guy who came to sharpen and your knives. I mean, right. Who does that?
Yeah.
Then there was, I mean, your typical ice cream man would come. We would have a ride. The ride's here. And there was this, like, half a swing ride, and you would pay a quarter to get on the ride. Yeah, oh. We had the vegetable store, the fruit store, the fish store. I have a funny fish story.
Give us it.
My mom sent me, every Friday we ate fish. There was certain, like, Sunday was gravy and meatballs. Friday was fish. She sent me to the fish store to get crabs, get a dozen crabs, live crabs. I'm like 7. I go down to the store. She puts the 12 crabs, and I'm walking home. The bag falls.
Oh, no.
So I get, by the time I get home, there's like 4 crabs left. Oh, she goes, where's the dozen crabs? And, well, one's heading towards the park. One's underneath the car. And they're live. No. So I was trying to get them back in the bag, but they're like snapping at me. I came home with 3 or 4 crabs. Sunday was
poor little Joanne.
The next item you'd like to take with you is a picture.
Ah.
Would you like to talk about said picture?
Sure. Well, it's a picture of me and my 4 other sisters. There are 5 girls, as I mentioned earlier, and we are all standing under the sort of sacred apple tree, which is in bloom. So I would imagine it was probably Memorial Day weekend, because that seemed to be when that always was in bloom. Mm-hmm. And we're laughing, and we're caught so off guard and so joyous and so full of life, and just, I think it's an amazing picture. I actually did show it to the two of you, because I do have it here with me.
Yeah, and, as a fantastic picture.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just so capturing a moment that I have lost 2 of the sisters that are in that photo. I've had 1 sister die of cancer and the other die very, very suddenly. Just one Friday morning, having a headache, and then we were taking her off life support by the end of the day, which was a very, very grueling experience. And that would be my sister Kate, who actually lived in this area and worked here in Hudson. So this picture captures a moment that can never be again, and right. yet... is such a moment of innocence and beauty, and whatever the future holds is sort of in that picture, not knowing what.
Right. And do you still, is the tree still alive? And do you know, can you go back to that tree again?
I can go back to that tree. The property has been passed on. It used to be the sort of the family compound. And after my dad died, through certain different things with the family, it has moved on to other people. It is close by where I live, and the kind of the most astonishing thing about this tree is that it has been broken in half, it has been run over, it has been, everything that could possibly have ever happened to this tree has happened to it, and yet there's always this one branch that blooms.
And that's the amazing thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And you've not aged a bit in the photograph from
until
now.
Oh, you're sweet. It's been a long time.
No, but you're right. You know, see, when people do get caught unawares, I think that's when you capture their beauty.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's when people actually stop, prepare and pose for a photograph that you actually lose that natural element.
Right.
And that photograph that you did show, myself and Mike, does illustrate very clearly the natural... than, you know, how natural the picture was.
Yeah, yeah. You know? That's what I think I love about it the most. It's just so natural and just so capturing a moment in life. And, you know, we try to do that with music, you know. Sometimes, you know, when you hear a song, you know, when you ask me about music, I thought of things like that. And film does that, and books can do that, and the arts. I mean, the arts, that's, I think, what the big thing is about the arts. You can capture moments and... just little snippets of life that you're not even aware of how important they are at the moment. And then you can get to look back on it. It has a whole new meaning.
It seems fairly obvious now why you would take the picture with you on your getaway, but why would you take the picture?
I would assume, you know, asking about a getaway in the Catskills is sort of a funny thing, since I already live in the Catskills and I live in Maple Crest, and it's a beautiful valley and it's very secluded and all that. So I'm sort of living that anyway. But
not in this cabin. This cabin is in a small place that you don't know of.
Then I definitely need the picture.
It's in Hudsonville.
So you're taking it, why?
I would assume that I would probably be writing while I was away on this, and I think that's a picture that I've always wanted to sit down and sort of write about, and I never have.
Right.
Absolutely. Another thing you might take to your Cabin of the Catskills, you know, going back to your NBC days, is a xylophone. Can we hear that?
Yep. I have it, and I'll play it for you. This is an actual xylophone that they used on the air in the studio, and I'll play that for you, and you'll hear what it sounded like.
Yeah, here
now,
it is.
No. Can I just say before you play it, being from Scotland and not being familiar with NBC, what exactly is the purpose of this xylophone?
It was to identify NBC, and it was NBC.
Right.
The tones matched that, so whenever you were on the broadcast, you knew that you were on NBC.
And this is an actual
and this
xylophone.
Is an actual xylophone that they used back then.
Wow. So in the studio right now, we have an actual xylophone from NBC.
That's correct.
Fantastic. Reggie, on you go. That is brilliant.
That was the tritone NBC xylophone, you guys. An actual genuine xylophone used on air, on the radio.
That's correct.
At the NBC studios.
Now, Reggie, did you steal it?
No, it was given to me because they became automated. And all these things were going out in the garbage. And I said, I'm going to take one. And they said, sure, go ahead.
And have you ever had it appraised or anything?
No.
Because I'm sure it's now, it's maybe
just
a class.
Sitting in my studio up here.
It's probably a classic.
It's part of history.
A piece of Americana, isn't it?
The next item you said that you were going to take, George, is the Encyclopedia Britannica. What's the reason for taking that? I mean, that's a lot of books, so...
Yeah, but you never said I couldn't, though.
No, absolutely, absolutely.
Like with me. So, as I can't take Wikipedia and any technological stuff like that, I decided to go for the Encyclopedia Britannica. Basically, when I was a kid, the thing that got me into reading and knowledge, which is one of my big things, and usually trivial knowledge as well, was these set of encyclopedias that my grandfather bought for the family years back, and they were passed down and passed on to me as a 4 or 5 year old kid. So for somebody who had that sort of desire for knowledge, these were like manna from heaven. They were fantastic. I can still remember how they looked, how they smelt, how I can still remember the pages and the texture of the pages, and they were vitally important to me, and they piqued my curiosity. So it would have to be a really massive encyclopedia like the Encyclopedia Britannica, I believe was started by two Scotsmen.
Yeah,
it's true. Yeah, yes. The Britannica is the oldest English language encyclopedia still being produced, and it was first published 1768 in Edinburgh, Scotland. It's 3 volumes.
Hey, Edinburgh.
Yeah.
That's where our friend John lives.
Yes, John Roberts stays in Edinburgh. A lovely city. It's you can just smell the history when you're walking through some of these small...
It's probably Britain's most beautiful city, I'd say.
I would have to agree with you there. I'm sure there's some that run close, Bath, Oxford, parts of London, parts of Glasgow, but for me, Edinburgh is such a beautiful place. There's nothing beats walking along Princes Street, the main street in Edinburgh, and seeing the castle at night time lit up. It's superb.
Oh, it's spectacular, yeah. So Encyclopedia Britannica is for me. That's the choice of book.
Now, do these books still exist, the family books, do they still exist?
I think my mother still got the dictionary. I think over the course of years, we sort of they fell into a state of disrepair, and we had to chuck them out. But she still got the dictionary and the thesaurus at home.
Right.
So still red leather bound, big thick thesaurus dictionary book. she still has that back at home in Glasgow. So,
and when you go back home, when you go back home, do you flick through it and have a little trip down memory lane?
Every now and again, when I'm back in my mum's, I spot it and I go, "Ah, I should really look at that." And then I decide to look at Wikipedia instead, which is quite sad. So,
it's just so darn convenient.
Indeed, this, you know, it's modern technology has made the picking up of books almost obsolete. However, I do like the feel of reading a book. I'll still read a book.
Yeah, physically read a book. Yeah.
A paperback book. Yeah. I prefer the book itself rather than reading it online. But there is something about the convenience of things like Wikipedia that is that appeals.
You mentioned earlier the smell of the book. I was in the library and Mike was with me one day. We went to the library in the College of St. Rose and we walked down to the basement and I said to Mike, "Can you smell that?" And he said, "What?" I said, "The old books, that's the smell of education, knowledge." And Mike was, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, Mike, you're more of a generation where computers were more used when you were going to college.
Yeah. My response was, "Whatever you say, weirdo. Burning electric is knowledge to me."
I was trying to be diplomatic there.
I thought it was your cologne.
Yeah. I mean, I was very, very fortunate. I went to a public school system that had a tremendous music program. Mm. And the people who taught were very, very skilled. And there were a number of people from Carnegie Mellon that were part of the faculty. Also Duquesne University, which has a big music school that's in Pittsburgh as well. Mm. So that was always, they always emphasized your capacity. They valued your capacity to reach that level. You know, sure. They pushed you and the expectation was high.
Which prepared you for
exactly
any interview situation or
right.
Audition
right.
for the university.
Yeah.
That was Just Like a Woman by Richie Havens.
Am I right in saying that Richie stayed in or was well known in the area of Saugerties and Woodstock?
Yeah.
Because I saw
he's still highly regarded in those areas, I believe.
Yeah, I saw a few posters and going to a couple of music stores in Woodstock. I would see pictures of him, you know, photographs with Richie and, you know, some of the shop owners and stuff like that. So he's one of these guys, as you say, he's always a smile on his face, always looking to. He was a genuinely good guy, you know. So. Rest in peace, Richie. You're well missed, mate.
Now, Georgia, another item you'd like to take to the cabin is a Yamaha guitar.
Yes, not just any Yamaha guitar, but my Yamaha guitar. I bought it when I was 16 years old. I spent about $300 on it many, many years ago, and it's been with me everywhere. It's been in the jailhouse and the pawnbrokers, it's been everywhere. And I've got it here with me now, and it's I've had many guitars over the years, but this one stayed my number one guitar.
So this is your trigger.
Call me Roy Rogers.
Yeah.
For those they'll mount me on this.
Willie Nelson's guitar is called Trigger. He said it for. Yeah. Decades, so I'm referring to Trigger.
I thought you were talking about Roy Rogers and his horse.
No, Willie Nelson's guitar is called Trigger. So.
Oh, yeah, the one with the big hole in it.
Yeah, so I was referring to that being your Trigger. So,
George,
yeah.
could you play a little something for us?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, that would be awesome.
You'd like to play one of your own songs?
Yeah, I'll play a little bit of Richie Havens, the song about Richie, as we were just talking about.
Excellent,
him there.
Excellent.
You might not be able to hear it very well, but I'll just give you a couple of bars of it, okay?
Fantastic.
Sure.
Comes the sun again, well I know it's alright. here in my world. God bless the man, cause he has given so much to me. Open my eyes, see what it's like to be free. Where Richie Haven sings, here comes the sun again. Well, I know it's all right here in my world.
Now, the next item that you'd like to take, Lynn, not surprisingly, is a radio.
I love the radio.
Really? Being the manager of a radio station.
True, that's a relief. Imagine if he was like, I cannot stand radio. I can't get away from radio soon.
And this predates my involvement with the radio station. I grew up listening to radio, you know, in the under the covers at night. That was and one of the best memories of my childhood was listening to baseball games.
Yeah,
on the radio with my dad.
I remember when I was growing up, at nighttime we'd lie in bed and listen to a guy Tom Ferry, and he would play like requests for people, you know, love songs for people, you know, a woman, a girl, maybe a 15-year-old did. Her boyfriend had left her. Can you play this song?
I know.
So lay in bed, listen to that sometimes.
Yeah. Or but, Larry King late at night.
Yeah.
In later years, you know, when he was actually good. When he was actually a real interviewer.
Right.
Sure.
And on the radio, yeah.
Well, I'm curious, what kind of radio did you have that you, you know, were able to snuggle under the covers with it and stuff?
I had a little transistor radio with an ear plug, you know, that I could listen one-sided, sort of like an earbud, but, you know, only on one side, and I would listen at night.
A transistor radio. That's what they called them in Scotland, was a tranny.
Oh, my.
So we all had trannies in Scotland. Yeah. When I was growing up. Guys would take the tranny with them to the radio, the soccer games, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Or these big hard men standing next to trannies.
Well, that would happen, too, with baseball games and football games. They'd listen to the play-by-play as they watched the baseball game.
Or the other thing we'd call them would be a wireless.
Mm-hmm.
We'd call them a wireless, you know.
Yeah.
But what you could take with you is a wind-up radio. You get wind-up radios now.
Right.
With the
crank gun.
The crank for when you're maybe caught up in a power outage. You can still listen to the radio,
right.
You know.
Right.
I remember years ago when I was playing in bands when I was like 17, guys would bring in their amps and their, you know, their amplifiers and their big speakers to for their guitars and the basses and stuff. And for some reason, they could pick up radio station. When the radio station they could pick up on the airwaves was Radio Luxembourg, which I found was quite interesting, you know?
Yeah, that's amazing.
That's just one of the memories. Now, do you know who one of the main guys was who created the radio?
Marconi.
Good. Well done. So it was Marconi, and there was another couple of guys who had claimed to fame to have created the radio. Tesla, Oliver Lodge, Heinrich Hertz, these guys as well.
Right.
But one other little piece of information, I don't know if you know this. Do you know who Marconi's great-grandfather was?
No.
Do you know, Mike?
I don't know.
John Jameson, founder of the Jameson Irish Whiskey.
No, really?
Yeah, you are.
Whoa.
So I don't know. I just found out last night. So
that
just
is
a little
very
bit
cool.
of information.
You would never associate those two things.
So Marconi and Jameson. So you
That's
can
right.
sit at night, listen to the radio, be a wee dram. Mm-hmm. The two go together.
And perfect. You know, Lynn, your next song is a adagio from the D minor concerto for oboe by Alessandro Marcello. And I was listening to this, and it actually reminded me of a song written within the past few years by a group called Marconi Union. And they're more contemporary. They create like a techno kind of music. But they created a song called Weightless and adagio from the D minor concerto reminded me of that, because it doesn't seem to have a particular melody or anything that repeats. It's just this like ebbing and flowing melody that kind of meanders mm-hmm. along, and that's what this Weightless song is like. And interestingly, this Weightless was written in collaboration with the British Academy of Sound Therapy, and supposedly through studies shows that it will reduce people's anxiety, however they measure that, by 65%. It'll bring a subject's resting pulse rate to 35% of their usual resting rate. Wow. And they actually tell people, don't listen to it while you're driving, because the studies have shown it'll put you to sleep.
That's a song you should have been playing for Bryce years ago. Not Fight the Power.
Weightless.
You're welcome.
The next thing you're taking to the Cabin of the Catskills is needlework.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've been doing needlework for tons and tons of years, and it takes me forever to do anything. And I've got a particularly nice counted cross stitch that I like to drag with me. It's been all over the country because that's how slow I work on it. And I just take it out and work really slowly, and just it's very relaxing.
You know, I really admire people who do that. My mum has been knitting for decades, and she knits clothes for babies and stuff like that. And it takes a real calm person to actually be able to sit and do this. You know, I think I would go off my rocker if I was to sit and try and knit or crochet or do needlework, because it's just so tedious for me. But for some people, it's very calming. Is it calming for you?
This particular stuff is. I used to do knitting, but I would be so intense about it to get things done that it actually kind of played havoc with my shoulder and my arm and stuff. So I don't do much knitting anymore, even though I like to do it. Right. But the needlework, the holes are so small, you have to take your time because I can't see them very well otherwise. But
how often do you stab your fingers?
Occasionally.
Yeah.
Now, forgive me for my ignorance here, but I really don't know what needlework is. I think I kind of know what crocheting is, but I don't know.
It involves
much about this.
A needle and work.
Yeah. Well, there's different things. I mean, this particular thing that I'm working on is called counted cross stitch, and they give you this page that's got all these little symbols in boxes, and the symbols match a color of thread, and then you have to go to this piece of cloth that has all these little holes punched in it and count out holes and make little cross stitches.
Yeah.
And it can be very tedious, but it's kind of mindless, calm
work. Well, you know, I used to be a stand-up comedian in Scotland, and I used to do gigs in Glasgow in the Stand Comedy Club, and there was a woman who was a compere, and she was she still is a fine comedian, and she used to sit in the back every Friday and Saturday night amongst all of the, you know, the comedians' egos and stuff, and she used to sit and do needlework mm-hmm. in between. And I was like, that's remarkable.
Yeah.
You know?
If you do the knitting and stuff, you really don't even have to. You can do other things, watch TV and stuff, because you do it by feel. I said, but I can't. The knitting bothers me, so I don't do it.
Yeah, because I watch my mum, and sometimes I look at her in awe because she's watching the television, drinking a cup of tea, and knitting. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how do you do that?
And, you know, Mark, another object you were going to bring with you is a roofing hammer.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, this might seem kind of
right. You've been dying to get to this roofing hammer.
I have. I know there's a story that's attached to this. So tell us, Mark, why a roofing hammer?
Well, I might have to tell you, go back to what I was telling you about this Reverend Burgers I keep mentioning.
You love your burgers, don't
yes,
you?
Yeah, he was something. He hired me to work. This was separate from camp. They had decided the church of the Nazarene decided they were going to remodel this campground. This campground was actually purchased by the church from I believe it was the Herald Tribune camp in the 1960s. So it was really primitive. And the camp was called Camp Taconic when the church bought it. And it was the camp and convention center for all the churches in what were called the Metro New York District. And so there was one point when the church had decided that they were going to remodel and kind of bring this campground up to date, specifically the dining hall. So the dining hall underwent this huge renovation remodeling project, and I was hired to work with construction crews. We were re-roofing the dining hall at one point, and it was getting to be cold at this point in time in the fall. It was November. we were getting very heavy frost. We would get up early with the men, and I was working with one man. His name was Billy Post. He was a kind of a Clint Eastwood type. He was, back to Clint Eastwood.
He wasn't he? Levi Clint?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did but he smoke cigars?
Yeah. No, he didn't. But we at one point in the project, we were working on the roof, and we had stripped all of the old roofing material off this roof. There was a very large building, very tall building with a peak. And so one morning after we had stripped the roof, we had the night before had layered the whole roof with tar paper. And as I said, we were getting very heavy frost that time of year.
That doesn't sound good.
Yep, no. And we got up early one morning, as we always did, probably 4:30, 5 o'clock. And I was helping him. He was in charge of me, you know. So we went up on the roof. On one side, the sun had come up, the side that we went up, and had burned all the frost off that side of the roof. So it was dry. And so we went up on this roof, and I had my hammer holster and my hammer, and we were ready to start work for the day. And the first thing he said to me was, I'd like you to go get an extension cord. Go walk up the roof over the peak and get an extension cord that I left wrapped around the chimney there. So that was what I did. I walked up the roof. I stepped over the peak and didn't see that the entire other side was frost and ice. And all I did was take one step. Yep, I took one step over and I lost my footing and I started to slide. The hammer, the reason I brought a roofing hammer, maybe your listeners know the difference between a roofing hammer and a framing hammer. Is that the roof?
Oh, yeah. I know that quite. No problem. Tell us,
A roofing hammer has a very pronounced hook on it.
Right.
A framing hammer, the claws come out more straight. And so it occurred to me maybe to use this hammer as I started to slide to stop myself, and I wasn't able to do that. So I was sliding and closer and closer to the edge, and I ultimately could not stop myself, and over the edge I went, and I fell to a lower roof a number of feet, and I landed on my side, and there I bounced up quite high in the air, and then I fell from that roof to the ground. And so...
Now, Mark, this initial fall, are we talking like 5 feet?
That was probably 15. The first fall was 15. And then from there, maybe 20 to the ground after that. So what happened was the men on the other side knew what had happened to me. And some of them had called out. And so they were on their way on foot. They were running. But they had a ways to go because they had to go around the building. Of course, I took the short way down, falling off the roof. You know, so I was on the ground. But I literally picked myself up before they got there, and they were arriving. I could see them running. They were all in a panic because they presumed the worst. But I saw them approaching, and I picked myself up off the ground, and I walked over to a set of steps that was there in front of the dining hall, and I sat down. And of course, they were all, you know, worried and in a panic. And so, this Reverend Burgers also happened to be a member of the Milan Rescue Squad. So he was very knowledgeable about what to do, how to handle me and handle what was happening there. So I wound up in an ambulance, and then I was taken to Northern Dutchess Hospital, where they performed many x-rays. They x-rayed probably every joint that there was. And the initial report was that I had fractured a pelvis, my pelvic bone, excuse me.
Elvis?
Yeah, and they gave me this pile of x-ray films, and they sent me home. And so my mother, they gave me, of course, crutches to walk on. And my mother took these x-ray films to a specialist in Kingston who said they were misread and that I really had no breaks, a little internal bleeding, he said, and I would be off crutches in a few days. And that's what happened. So
wow. So you, let me get this straight. You fell 35, 40 feet.
Yeah.
And... nothing.
I picked myself up and I walked away.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah,
that's really, really fortunate.
Yes,
kind of miraculous.
And can I just ask one question? What's sure. this got to do with a hammer?
What's that?
What's this got to do with a hammer?
Because he was going to save himself plummeting.
Oh yeah, I was hoping to use the claws of the hammer to stop myself.
So the hammer didn't help you.
It didn't because the claws were too.
But it made the cut
much.
To take to the cabin.
Yeah,
in hopes that the next time around, you know that
if you're falling again, the hammer's not going to help you again.
All right, this time, old trusty. This is happening.
I thought you were going to take it to kill an animal or something.
It was an important, even though it didn't help me, it was, I
it
guess
represented
you could say,
it's your
a representative of, yeah, of the fact that, that day could have turned out very differently.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, me
obviously,
too.
Glad to hear that nothing happened to you.
Joanna, another item you'd like to bring is a photo of family and friends. And I'm really, it's a cool theme that I'm seeing here, that family is very important to you.
Family is important. And the reason I would like to bring a photo with me is, you know when you haven't seen someone in a really long time, and then like you go through your photo album, which is kind of being a thing of the past almost, because nobody takes them, you know, takes them off the digital camera. You just kind of see them on the computer. But a photograph is kind of cool. It's almost like reading a book. Mm-hmm. And that photo could take you back to that moment. You could either be laughing, and like it just brings you back to, I remember that moment, or it could be a sad moment, or a wedding picture, or someone that's passed away. But it brings you, I don't know, that closeness to your heart.
Yeah.
It's
so
a photo in Cabin in the Woods would be like, I feel by myself. I feel alone. Oh, look, here's a picture of my friends. Oh, I remember that day. Oh, that day was so much fun.
We had a chipmunk. And in the years gone by, my wife and I would sit out there at night. You know, we have a cocktail, and we'd sit there, and we had this chipmunk that came up and looked at us. And it was kind of funny. It was like we had developed a relationship just by looking at one another. So my wife said, I'm going to get some peanuts. And we got peanuts. And so all of a sudden, a chipmunk comes up, and we call him Henry. Well, it got to a point, believe it or not, and everybody can try this, with a peanut, we'd call Henry, and he'd come. And he'd come running up, and he'd get to our, you know, close to us about a foot. And then he got about 6 inches away. Then he got on my shoe. And then he got on my knee. And the next thing you know, I'm feeding Henry right without my hand. And it was a kind of an interesting thing, because we go out and say, where's Henry? And here comes Henry. For 4 years, we had Henry come up on our deck to eat peanuts. Well, we had a cocktail party. And in the cocktail party, we had this refined lady with the pearls, you know, around the neck.
Mm-hmm.
Very refined, with all of nice clothing and everything else. All the people were having a good time. Music was playing. Uh-huh. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw Henry coming. And I said, oh, we're in trouble. He came up the porch and jumped in this lady's lap, and I thought she would have a heart attack.
Oh, no.
The drink went one way, and the other thing went, she let out a war whoop. And Lois said, that's just Henry, but she didn't know.
You do have really good food. I've tasted it myself. And you have won a couple of awards, haven't you?
We have won a few awards. The Buckaroo Burger, we have second year in a row, top 10 burgers in New York State, as per the New York Beef Council. And just recently we did the Hunter Mountain Wing Festival, where we took down best hot sauce, best garlic, and best wing overall with our chicken and waffles wing.
Yeah, fantastic.
Just out of curiosity, what is on the Buckaroo Burger?
The Buckaroo Burger is simple in its beauty. It's two mozzarella sticks covered in barbecue sauce, bacon cheeseburger, onion rings on top of that.
Nice.
My friends and I just went over the winter. We went down to a bar in Durham, and we rode the bull. And we have some classic pictures.
Can we just clarify for the listeners, people listening in?
It's a mechanical bull. It's a mechanical bull.
Got some bull in a bar.
Yeah. It was fun. And I went with people that you didn't think would get on a mechanical. I didn't think I would ever do it, but I could check it off my bucket list now.
Oh, super.
It was fun.
How long did you do the 8 seconds? Did you do the 8 seconds? Is that?
I got close,
yeah?
But nothing fell. And I have that picture hanging now at my desk at work.
Those are some of our favourite moments from the last year. Both of us are looking forward to 2015 and the fun we will have getting to know our future guests a little bit better. We would like to thank you also for listening throughout the past year. And to end our show, we'd like to reflect on our guests' responses to our trademark question.
How do you take your coffee?
Really? That's the question, huh? Light and sweet.
Oh, well, it depends. Black or with cream?
With almond milk, three ice cubes, and a stevia.
Milk and sugar.
Nice.
Yeah, regular.
Light and sweet.
Back when I used to drink coffee, it was black. I take my coffee first thing in the morning. Don't even talk to me until I have it. With half and half, no sugar.
Hi, I'm Andy Reid.
And I'm Mike Porter. And you've been listening to Catskill Cabin Conversations.
Special thanks to George, Gordon, and Billy from the band White for the theme music, and everybody at WGXE ACRA. Thanks.
Merry Christmas and have a Happy New Year.